All right, there was a lot in there. So let's start to peel that back and just pick some topics. I think one of the key points you're making is that the role for government in planning the community declined, and we allowed the markets or the anarchy or the organic nature of communities to develop on its own without a central authority. And I'm wondering about, just stepping way back, about the field of urban economics in general. There was a sense, I think, in the 1960s that government could solve most problems. You had public housing, LBJ's public housing programs, et cetera. And then there's, Kiro speaks about, where we should put our highways. What's going on in terms of the belief among the intellectual elite and their powers to transform American society through city planning? And is that what's going on? Is there's a sense that the city planner is ineffective in his utopian ideals and have left it to the market to solve problems?
I don't think it's come out of a self-conscious decision at top levels. What's disappeared is something that's kind of ineffable and hard to inchoate, hard to get your hands on. But it is, I think we use the middle third of the 20th century as a kind of touchstone for our thinking about how government interrelates with social developments. And that period, well, really the 50 years from about 1915 to 1965, were very unusual. They were periods where the development of the First World War, the Depression, the Second World War brought a general deference to centralized power that lasted long until about 20 years after the Second World War. And that enabled central leadership at all levels to be more confident and be more coherent and organized. And when that fell apart, and I would take 1965 as the marking year, there was a collapse of the general popular deference to central power. And it wasn't as if, for example, the highway planners, whether it was Caro criticizing Moses in New York, or whether it was the protesters in Beverly Hills fighting Sacramento's highway plans, it wasn't as if the highway planners had lost confidence or lost their plans. It was that there was resistance. Now, these resistors had no connection to the people who were doing what's called the Watts riots. These were opposite parts of society to some extent. And yet there was all of a sudden a kind of a challenge to centralized leadership. I don't know how many of your listeners remember the ethos, the feel of times in the Watergate era, but that was another period when you could see the collapse of charisma, when the disgrace happened to the center, to the presidency. All sorts of deferences to authorities at lower levels all of a sudden disappeared. So I can recall I was doing research in Brooklyn in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the 70s, and cases started to come up that targeted smoking marijuana in the Merchant Marine Academy. I mean, the sorts of things that nobody would have raised questions about. But all of a sudden, people started to raise questions about what people or institutions that had power had been doing. And so there was a general collapse. The Watergate was a kind of domino collapse that followed the, if you think about it, look at the leaders in the Western world. Eisenhower was in power, a military leader, until the 60s. De Gaulle lasted until the late 60s. Franco lasted until the mid-70s. It took a long time for the popular will, and then you had a sea change, and that's very hard for social science to get its hands on, because social science, its methods like to study things that change year to year in kind of ordinal fashion. But there are major shifts that start to occur in the mid-60s as this charisma of the center, this general deference that the population had, whether it was in democracies or in fascist or in communist countries, to centralized power, that starts to fade away. Without the support of mass traumas from the two world wars and the Depression, we may now be realizing what we're fighting against, all the kind of chaos and conflict and the inability of the center to lead, what is the normal series of events that we find it difficult to appreciate because our touchstone is this unusual period of history that was marked by these mass traumas. So, go ahead.
What I was going to say, I was going to break into the religious Jewish experience in the Hollywood community, which you touched on. And your graduate student and mutual friend, Ido Tavari, who has been, he's spoken twice on What Happens Next, most recently about HIV in Malawi and the work he did there. But he did his dissertation and he worked with Jack for what became his book, Summoned, about religious life in Los Angeles. And I think what's interesting, I don't know this Jewish community in Hollywood at all, but it does remind me of other other places around the country. So I am currently living in Miami Beach, and I'm living a couple of blocks away from a very intensive Orthodox Jewish community. And I was asking myself all these sort of questions, like, what are they doing here? And also, why do I want to live right next door to them? And what kind of life do they lead that is that touches a Hispanic neighborhood here in Miami? And so I want to ask you this question, Jack. My first one is this really all about that seeds matter? And what I mean by that is Hollywood had a secular Jewish community. And I think that that was an important seed that allowed, it must have had some basic institutions that would allow for a Jewish life. And did those initial seeds encourage very Orthodox Jews to move into that community? And then, boom, that had an immediate positive feedback loop, and then replacing the secular Jewish community in full. What do you think happened? What happened here in Hollywood?
Okay. Well, there was a secular Jewish community, and it was actually, in large part, anti-religious. So a lot of people were close to socialism and not enthusiastic. And the Orthodox had, for decades, since the 1920s, tried to organize a more pious, a more observant community without success. They started to gain success in the 1970s when a number of things were happening. But again, you know, the collapse of the charisma of the center, the central control, is not just a U.S. question. So you have, after the various wars in the Middle East, you've got Jewish populations on the move out of North Africa. You've got the breakdown, the Soviet control of Jews who want to leave. And it's not just that Americans are converting, although that's happened to some extent. It's also that people are coming, Jews are coming out of various places. They first go to Israel, and then they come to the U.S., and they become part of the constituency. A lot of the new synagogues had particular ethnic complexions. They might be Iraqi Jews who are populating them. They're North African Jews. They're Jews who maybe from Latin America who are moving out. So it's a kind of collapse of, in a way, colonialism and the after effects, the population movements that start to, so that's part of the story. Yes, the seeds were there. I like to think about it as repurposing infrastructure. There was an infrastructure of Jewish population that was somewhat accommodating, although it was also somewhat hostile because the Jewish Federation didn't want to compete with the new orthodoxy in soliciting money from contributors. So it wasn't always positive, but yeah, there were institutions to take over. And then there were very wealthy Jews who had been secular much of their lives, some of them Holocaust survivors, who had made fortunes in the post-war developments of L.A. in one area, in retirement homes. As the Jewish community got older, real estate developers got together and started to build facilities, and then they saw the opportunity to manage them as retirement homes, and that became part of the wealth basis that the Orthodoxy, sending people from New Jersey and Brooklyn and connecting with these people, who became more observant later in life, as not often, as often occurs, they start to get donors. So it's a mix of these factors, but it's also, I would emphasize what's usually not talked about, which is events outside the nationalist focus we tend to have. In this case, the breakdown of colonialism. There were Jews coming from various countries, South Africa even, Argentina, Mexico, and hearing about this very attractive new population community, new population center for Orthodox Jews, and providing some of the population base. That plus, it was very important because the private school tuitions that the Jewish schools depend on, that was aided by the resistance, the whole conflict about mandatory busing to promote school integration. And that coincided in the 1970s with the cheap real estate that was available. And so new schools got developed, and Jewish schools were only part of the expansion of the private school system. Catholic schools and non-denominational sectarian schools also emerged in this period. But that was also a resistance to centralized authority in the school board. So I think the novel part of the story that I have to tell has to come out of this breakdown of faith or a presumed deference to centralized authority at many different levels, and all of it uncoordinated. Nobody's in charge. Nobody's saying, the same people aren't saying, let's end colonialism, let's end mandatory busing, let's stop the state highway authorities from bringing a new highway through our neighborhood. It's a very diffuse, and so it's because of the diffusion, it's very hard to see unless you put together, unless you start from the neighborhoods and work out, it's very hard to see this.
The other point you're trying to make is the strange juxtaposition of such different cultures, religions, and political views. And I want to focus on one. Let's compare the transvestite, gay stores, movie theaters, sex shops, right next to the Orthodox Jewish community. That would be something that you wouldn't guess would be possible. In Summon, this is Ido Tavari's book, he talks about that the Orthodox Jewish women would walk on side streets to go around the sex shops to get to the shul and back home. How do you think about this strange juxtaposition of different cultures, a desire to be both close but not to mix? Because I would have thought that one of the fantastic parts about the disorganized, organic anarchy of these neighborhoods is that for someone like me who's much more open to different sort of cultures, that it allows me to enjoy the beauty of the randomness, the beauty of the differences. But in other cultures where they're trying to be separate, why would the ones who want to be separate are so close?
Yeah, you know, it's in a way, this is how city neighborhoods have developed in the past. If you look at, there was a great book, The Gold Coast and the Slum, that was published in the late 1920s in Chicago. And it wasn't just the Gold Coast on Lake Michigan and the slum some blocks east, but it was also Little Sicily. So there's an ethnic low-income neighborhood, and it was the Hobohemia, the homeless. And it was also Tower Town, which was bohemian. And then around the historic water tower. So there was a variety of people living next to each other emerging at the turn of the 20th century from mass immigration, in part because even as zoning came into power at about that time in history, nobody was zoning for ethnics or for the cultural fabric. That emerged in a way anarchically, and the people going to one area one kind of neighborhood, weren't necessarily interested in, and had problems of a sensed vulnerability if they went into other neighborhoods on both sides. I mean, the Gold Coast people are not going to be very comfortable in Hobohemia, and the hobos know that they're going to be picked up and pushed out if they show up on the Gold Coast. And similarly, it's not just the Orthodox Jews and this kind of hip, youth-oriented sex and drugs culture nearby that are wary of each other. It's also that the low-income Central American immigrant knows that they're going to stand out if they are go a few blocks west and go into a higher-income area, except if they're there as workers. So this is part of what urban social life has been in the past and became at the end of the 20th century. It's not a novel phenomenon, but it's in part because nobody is kind of designing this for complementary and mutual respect and mutual appreciation, except for the young people who come in the bohemian neighborhoods and the interstices of some of these neighborhoods. The bohemian areas develop, and they, as kind of culture consumers and tourists, like to go to the ethnic restaurants. They like to look maybe at the historic homes. They appreciate. But they're a very small part of even the population of bohemian areas. There may be 20% of an area that's mostly working class or poor. But the people in the other areas are focused on the themes in their lives and in their neighborhoods, and wary often. Very wary. I mean, people in the hills and the canyons, one of the couples I interviewed, the wife used to sneak out to go shopping in the low-income Latino neighborhood and didn't want her husband to know about it because he'd be afraid for her, so that sort of thing. This is not the wariness is not uncommon.
Let me expand on that. So just for the benefit of our listeners, Jack was just commenting on a book called The Gold Coast and the Slum. It's by Harvey Zorba. Is that how you pronounce it, Jack?
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Anyway, the book was published in 1929, and it's kind of a neighborhood-by-neighborhood analysis of Chicago. And it comes out of the University of Chicago School of Sociology. And I read this book, and I read it because I had an apartment on the corner of Huron and Michigan, and I knew this area very well. And I was just interested in learning about what that neighborhood looked like 100 years before. And what I found, to Jack's point, was just a couple of blocks away on Huron and, let's say, Orleans, which is about 5 or 6 blocks from where my apartment is, which I'm currently trying to sell. But in that neighborhood, what Zorba said is it was 100% Sicilian. Not like 99%, like 100. It was 100% Sicilian. And Chicago was a very segregated, but not only just by race, but by where you were from. So there's Czech neighborhoods and Polish neighborhoods and Russian neighborhoods and Swedish neighborhoods, et cetera. But what's really interesting is that right next to this Sicilian neighborhood on Orleans and Huron, just across Chicago Avenue was the Moody's Church. And this is an evangelical church that was also a school, a university of evangelism. And they would produce students, and these students would go to the Sicilian section, and they would preach to the Sicilians to change their ways and become more religious in their behaviors. And in the book, Zorba describes that they would throw tomatoes at the Moody's preachers. Mm. And what I think is interesting about that story is, and going back to my original question to you, Jack, about seeds, because today the Moody's Church and the Moody's School is still there, and it's probably 25 times larger. It's just an enormous segment of that community. But all the Sicilians are gone, okay? There's probably nobody left. And it's been replaced by my niece lives there. I mean, it's like a very up-and-coming, yuppie community on those blocks. And I'm just trying to understand how the Chicago School of Sociology thinks about the development of the importance of the seed of the Sicilians and the Moodys, that the Moodys are still left, but the Sicilians are gone, and how those neighborhoods change with time given the economics and opportunities.
Right. Okay, so let me take your seed label and turn it into path dependency, which is the way a lot of social research
that's what I'm asking.
Think about things. So, and I thought we might talk about one of the issues that came up in your conversation with Ed Glaser about post-COVID, what's happening to the city. Will the city come back and how it will come back? And I thought of a good path dependency example would be where the new studio development is happening now. There's massive new development of new production facilities and office facilities related to entertainment production in LA now. Now, when the movie industry was created, it was really centered in Hollywood between 1907 and 1915, and it was all in the center of Hollywood. There was a particular intersection that was famous for having lots of different studios around. By the late 20s, by the 1920s, movie studios had made enough financial progress, sound was coming in, they had to expand. Where did they expand? They didn't expand in place. They went 10 miles out to Burbank, to Colton.
That's interesting.
Okay. Warner's and Universal went to Burbank. Culver City was created to host MGM. MGM was a combination of Metro and Goldwyn that were separate entities. 20th Century Fox was also a combination. They went to what became Century City near south of Beverly Hills. Now you have 100 years later, the 2020s, starting about 5-10 years ago, major expansion of the studios. Where is it happening? It's happening not another 10 miles out, but it's happening based on the path that the studios took in the 1920s, and it's happening all around the nodes that were then established. So the seeds, as you say, or the path dependencies, or the constraints on further movement out, they're not going another 10 miles out. They're not going from Burbank way up to the Northeast Valley. Warner's has the biggest studio expansion in the country going on now, a Frank Gehry designed buildings, and it's in Burbank. Where MGM was in Central City, in Culver City, there's Sony, Amazon, HBO, Apple are all developing studio-related facilities. In Hollywood, right near the original center of all the studios, Netflix and Viacom and new studios are being developed. So over time, the path dependencies are getting stronger. And what that means for post-COVID is even as Ed Glaser pointed out, you can track rentals, you can track vacancies in office space, and there are some indicators of people not signing up for the same square footage or signing up at lower prices or less profitable businesses coming in where more profitable were. There's that trend, but there's also this divergent trend of path dependencies being stronger than ever. So the cities will come back explosively. I think the 2020s is going to be an explosive growth period, kind of like the 1920s was, where LA's population more than doubled. And a lot of what COVID meant was a lot of construction projects could really move quickly because there was no traffic holding things up and other kinds of openings occur. And there's a tremendous amount that's coming on, will be coming online very shortly. When these new buildings come online, which are residential as well as production facilities, retail will become very, very dynamic around them. Population densities will increase, but they'll increase around the nodes that were established by the 1920s. They're not going to be spread out further out. And there's a kind of dialectic of sprawl that by having created housing, a more equal housing series of possibilities in the region about 10 to 20 miles out, now to locate a new production facility or office building on this bigger circle, on any parts of the bigger circle, you're requiring your employees to commute potentially a much further distance from another end of that circle. And so it becomes sprawl kind of feeds and gives a dynamic that gives more economic appeal to development at the center. So there are divergent kinds of movements in process here, the high-tech facilitating work from home, but also the path dependencies of the cities getting stronger over time.
I'm just wondering if that's consistent with our organic nature of the change. Let me give you an example from Philadelphia for a second. So I attended the University of Pennsylvania, and it's got a campus, and they want to expand. And there's also this sense that there's, like, the science departments wants to work with pharmaceutical labs and in these sort of joint ventures, thinking like Silicon Valley is with Stanford. And so Penn wants to expand, but it's in the middle of Philadelphia. So, like, what can they do? And there's, like, two options. One is that they can go towards the river, and where it's kind of industrial right now, and rezone it to allow for Penn to go in one direction and then also work with industrial labs. And then it can also go towards the river, towards Center City, and expand there as well. So the reason why I mention this, it seems like there's a two-prong issue. One is you're caught by your path dependency because the U of Penn's campus is where it is. Okay, we're not moving the campus. And next question is where is vacant land? Where can we rezone? What can we do to deal with our future growth? And I think that's kind of the story you're telling me also in Hollywood. What's the cheapest land where I can expand big that's close enough to my existing spot?
Yeah, that's the calculation. I think what's happened since the 1920s is that the region has been built out. So you've got upper middle income homes 20 miles out in all directions, in the South Bay, up to Woodland Hills in the Northwest. And there's not cheap land even further out. So I think that's been missing from a lot of the thinking about the, quote, return to the city. What's happened is that the land further out is no longer so much cheaper than land closer in. So the development does have it does happen on expensive land. The Culver City developments of HBO and Sony and Apple and so forth are happening in an area that's already the west side of LA, which is a relatively affluent area. They're buying up the land, paying the higher prices than they would have paid decades ago, but if they're going to go further out, they're also going to pay much higher prices than they would have paid decades ago. Burbank, for example, is not the kind of low-profit farming area that it was when Warner's and Universal first moved out there, and areas further out are already subdivided. And putting together lots to make enough space is a challenge further out as well as it is further in. There's another factor that goes on here that I think is interesting to talk about, and that's the sludge factor, that market forces face social psychological barriers in multiple ways before development takes off. And one is that towards the center of cities, you've got more corporate ownership of land. As you go out to the residential neighborhoods, you've got more family ownership of lands of lots that are rented for business and that are rented for apartment houses. That's a kind of family sludge in the sense that you often have to wait for the elderly parents to die and the kids to fight over and be unable to reach an agreement about how to manage this property before you get a sale back into the market. Towards the central city, you've got more corporate ownership, and it's easier, quicker to put together moving towards the highest and best use of the land. So that's a historical process that's in course now in many cities. It's clearly in LA. And there are other sludge factors that are kind of going to be processed through to move development more quickly towards towards the center, but that's one that affects the turnover of use of land that isn't taken into account, I think, enough.
We had what Jack is referencing is an Ed Glaser discussion on what happens next a few weeks ago. And I wanted to go to something Ed had to say about Southern California specifically. What he did was he complained about sort of like this organic anti-zoning, anti-new building approach that was in our zoning process, which has prevented large-scale developments in California, and that has resulted in a huge increase in real estate prices, which makes both business expensive and living there expensive. And there's this huge wealth given to the older generation at the expense of the young. And young people have to make the following decision: should they live in very cramped space in California, or should they move to a state with less restrictive zoning like Texas or Nevada or Arizona, where they can get a large piece of property for very little, and you know they'll deal with the job concerns there later. How do you think about what Ed had to say about zoning as it relates to this anarchic organic process of city development?
When in 1986, in particular, in the city of L.A., they had a downzoning proposition that local politicians promoted and that won overwhelmingly, and that made it harder to build density. It kind of blocked a lot of more dense development. And yes, that had a major effect on increasing land prices and increasing the price for buying or renting. That's another part of the sludge factor, because it's taken 25 to 30 years for the general population to realize the negative consequences, and now you're starting to see a turnaround. About 5 years ago, the city passed another measure that gave zoning officials a little more power to allow more dense development, and that is happening. That is starting to happen. It's not, and there will be an impact on rental prices in the next 5-10 years that'll be significant. But it's a minor shift. But it takes a long time for the public to realize the negative effects of this downzoning and the undemocratic, and to become discontent with the undemocratic nature of the overall process, where if you really do the math and work it out, it's about 1% of the population, in a very Republican way, in the classic terms of it, the more educated, affluent people who are controlling the land use decisions for the vast majority of people who don't live in the city when the votes are occur, but those votes set up a zoning structure that lasts for 25, 30 years until it's revised, where new people come in and they don't have any vote in affecting things. So there's a kind of anti-democratic and real estate inflating effect of this kind of attack on giving power to central planners to maximize development. Now that started to erode, and it's possible there'll be votes on major new initiatives that will allow much more density to develop. So I think of that as another, even longer term sludge factor before the public gets aware of the repercussions. And then there's also a sludge factor before developers get aware and get to be believers in the new development possibilities, because it's been 5-10 years since the state and the city have loosened a little bit the opportunity for dense development. And some of the projects that are now permitted that weren't before are only now coming online. And developers aren't really sitting in one room talking to each other. It takes them in their dispersed locations. Some of them are in Canada. Some of them are in Texas, to figure out that they can have faith that their projects, more dense projects, will get through. So that takes time to work out. Time is the big missing kind of consideration in a lot of our urban social thinking, I believe.
Let me try a different aspect to the strange juxtaposition of different communities. And I want to give an example like Crown Heights, where you have an Orthodox Jewish community next to an African-American community, and they really don't get along. And there was an incident where a very religious man was trying to go to visit the Lubavitch event and ended up running over and killing an African-American child, and that resulted in rioting and a lot of anger between the African-American and Orthodox Jewish communities. And when you have such radical differences in religious, political, sociological, wealth differences, oftentimes this can result in a fight. How do you think about the idea of can't everyone just get along when they're just so different? How do we, you know, and some level we're so excited and about the opportunity of this mixed neighborhood, mixed residential area of different cultures, but sometimes that results in violence. How do you think about the good and the bad associated with putting different communities together?
Well, you know, the communities, I don't know that anybody's putting them together. They're getting put together as dispersed people are making decisions over time, and obviously, you want to avoid conflicts if you can. But I think that the looming reality that has not yet come to surface is a fuller appreciation of just how overwhelmingly the urban populations in the New York and the L.A. area and increasingly in other parts of the country are dominated by foreign-born cultures. That is to say, if you look at households in New York and L.A., you'll find that almost two-thirds of the households are shaped. People are living in everyday cultures in their homes and in their neighborhoods that are shaped by people who were born in another country. In L.A., it happens to be more Mexican and Latin America. It's more diverse in New York. But our discussions tend to be about black-white. And that's a very, and that is, for good historical reasons, there are a lot of very important moral issues to attend to. But the demographic realities, at some point, there'll be another sea change when this will flip. And the new discussions will be about the foreign-born against, I don't know if this is going to be a hostile or antagonistic matter, but that will become more and more appreciated in the media. The numbers are so overwhelming. There's such overwhelming majorities of foreign-born households in areas that are still represented by U.S.-born people who have been in the country for centuries or decades, many generations. And that's not, so there's an under, this kind of undemocratic nature of our whole public discourse, which for perhaps defensible moral reasons, emphasizes black-white conflicts, but is really more about this, the U.S. as an immigrant nation again, and that shift in discussion and in themes in the popular media is likely to come in a kind of sea change not far off in the future.
All right. That's going to end our discussion here with Jack, and we're going to go with something completely different.